This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Fiction Podcast from The New Yorker Magazine. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. Each month, we invite a writer to choose a story from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, we're going to hear UFO in Kushiro by Haruki Murakami, translated from the Japanese by Jay Rubin, which was published in The New Yorker in March of 2001.
Each article contains some new tragedy, but to Komuro, those tragedies registered as oddly lacking in depth. The aftermath of the earthquake was like a distant, monotonous echo to him. The only thing he could give any serious thought to was his wife's drawing ever further away.
The story was chosen by Brian Washington, whose debut story collection, Lot, was published last year, and whose first novel, Memorial, will come out in October. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Deborah. How are you?
I'm all right. Doing okay. So we're here to talk about Murakami, and I get the sense that he's been important to you as a writer. Why is that?
I think that it's a question of timing on my end. I didn't really grow up as voracious of a reader as a lot of my peers. And I think that the authors and creators that I had first contact with in depth have an outsized influence on how I view form and structure. But I came across Haruki Murakami, and the first work that I read from him was Kafka on the Shore. And I just remember feeling as if I were reading something that I just hadn't been not only privy to, but just like a sort of reality that I hadn't imagined even. It was a very visceral, very surreal experience reading him for the first time.
What stage of your life were you at then? Were you in college or?
I was in my second year of college then, and I hadn't had too much exposure to quote-unquote literary fiction at that point. So as far as an introduction, it was a pretty serious one, so to speak.
What was it about his writing and about his style that was so novel for you?
I think that the mixture of accessibility and the depth of the narrative was something that was really striking to me, right? The way in which it was working on 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different levels without leaning too heavily on a lexicon. Like, I could clearly understand the vernacular across the page whilst attempting to navigate like 3 and 4 layers of story, which is just something that was really fascinating to me, but also something that impressed itself pretty deeply on me.
Yeah. The words are very simple, but there's always things happening under them and over them and around them that are harder to get to. So
right. And like another thing that was just super interesting to me is the way in which the reader's hand wasn't held, or rather my hand as a reader wasn't held, right? Like the details were there and the context was there, and it was left to me to put it together and make it make sense in a way that made the rest of the story make sense. And that reliance upon the reader in the storytelling process, like thinking of it as like an active process between storyteller and reader, is something that was just super fascinating to me.
So Japan has also played a role in your life and is an element in your new novel. What is the connection for you to that place?
The first time that I went was just as a sort of vacation because it was something that I'd always wanted to do, and the opportunity just sort of appeared in a way that I never expected it to. And then I made friends over there. So as opportunities continued to arise for work or for pleasure, I just took the chance to go. Just the notion of traveling in general had always seemed very out of reach. So once it became less out of reach, it was something that I leaned into. For the novel specifically, I think that what I was really interested in parsing for that was the sort of quiet moments that can permeate a relationship with a partner, with a parent or a sibling and so on. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when we're trying to define those relationships, they're characterized by the capital letter moments, so to speak, right? The ones with the fireworks. But very few relationships are capital letter moment after capital letter moment. You know, it's like the quiet moments in which, you know, you're able to create a life with someone. So I think that the question for me with the novel was, what would a narrative featuring the communities that I care about, communities of color, marginalized folks, queer communities of color, that was mostly made up of those quiet moments, like what would that look like? And how could I imbue that with humor and warmth without at the same time sacrificing the sadness that can sometimes permeate them as well? And I think that the decision to have a good chunk of it in Osaka as well as Houston was one that came pretty naturally, because it's just this place that I've spent a good deal of time in where I felt very welcomed by friends and by the community over there.
Mm-hmm. And this story, UFO and Kushiro, also involves, in a sense, well, the falling apart of a relationship that hasn't had enough capital letter moments. What about this story is special for you? What made you want to read it today?
When I originally chose it, we weren't on lockdown. So that in itself has been a surreal experience, right? The first time that I read after the quake was a few years ago. And I've since returned to that collection, which the story is from, every couple of months since then. And I think that the way that Murakami approaches a cataclysmic event without harping or, I suppose, centering on the event itself so much as the reverberation surrounding it was one that was really interesting, right? Because, you know, any event affects folks in a multiplicity of ways, right? Like, you and I are experiencing this quarantine together, but you and I have vastly different experiences of that quarantine, right? So any text that was able to approach that was just like immediately interesting to me. But UFO and Kushiro specifically, I think that it's such a quiet story, and yet there is extraordinary tragedy just outside of it, and the potential for extraordinary violence on the inside of it. The volleying between the two without leaning too heavily on either one of them is something that I just can't figure out, you know, and I think that that unknowability for me on my end is part of what makes it so interesting.
We should probably specify that this story and all of the stories in the collection after the quake are set right after the earthquake in Kobe in 1995. But I also, like you, find it especially interesting to read them in light of where we are right now in 2020.
Yeah, which is entirely beyond. But I think that it's also fascinating to read in light of the question that I've seen floating amongst peers and friends of, like, how do we write about ourselves, the world, and the sort of reevaluation of physical space in light of quarantine, in light of COVID, in light of the structural shifts that we are all facing, right, implicitly or explicitly. And I think that this story and that collection at large is one response to it, like one route to approach. I think that that makes it worth exploring and re-exploring to me.
Absolutely. And now here's Brian Washington reading UFO and Kushiro by Haruki Murakami, translated from the Japanese by Jay Rubin.
UFO and Kushiro. 5 straight days she spent in front of the television, staring at crumbled banks and hospitals, whole blocks of stores in flames, severed rail lines and expressways. She never said a word. Sunk deep in the cushions of the sofa, her mouth clamped shut, she wouldn't answer when Komodo spoke to her. She wouldn't shake her head or nod. Komodo could not be sure that the sound of his voice was even getting through to her. Komodo's wife came from way up north in Yamagata, and, as far as he knew, she had no friends or relatives who could have been hurt in Kobe. Yet she stayed planted in front of the television from morning to night. When he got up, Komodo would make his own toast and coffee and head off to work. When he came home in the evening, he'd fix himself a snack with whatever he found in the refrigerator and eat it by himself. She'd still be glaring at the late news when he dropped off to sleep. In his presence, at least, she ate nothing and drank nothing, and never went to the toilet. A stone wall of silence surrounded her. Komodo gave up trying to break through. And when he came home from work on Sunday, the sixth day, his wife had disappeared. Komodo was a salesman at one of the oldest audio equipment stores in Tokyo's Akihabara electronics town. He handled high-end stuff and earned a sizable commission whenever he made a sale. Most of his clients were doctors, wealthy independent businessmen, and rich provincials. He had been doing this for 8 years and had earned a decent income right from the start. The economy was healthy, real estate prices were rising, and Japan was overflowing with money. Wallets were bursting with 10,000 yen bills, and everyone was dying to spend them. The most expensive items were often the first to sell out. Komodo was tall and slim and a stylish dresser. He was good with people. In his bachelor days, he had dated a lot of women. But after getting married, at 26, he found that his desire for sexual adventures simply and mysteriously vanished. He hadn't slept with any woman but his wife during the 5 years of their marriage. Not that the opportunity had never presented itself, but he had lost all interest in fleeting affairs and one-night stands. He much preferred to come home early, have a relaxed meal with his wife, talk with her a while on the sofa, then go to bed and make love. This was everything he wanted. Komodo's friends were puzzled by his marriage. Next to his clean, classic looks, his wife could not have seemed more ordinary. She was short, with thick arms, and she had a dull, even stolid appearance. And it wasn't just physical. There was nothing attractive about her personality either. She rarely spoke, and her expression was often sullen. Still, though he himself did not quite understand why, Komodo always felt his tension dissipate when he and his wife were together under one roof. It was the only time he could truly relax. He slept well with her, undisturbed by the strange dreams that had troubled him in the past. His erections were hard, his sex life was warm. He no longer had to worry about death or venereal disease or the vastness of the universe. His wife, on the other hand, disliked Tokyo's crowded, urban lifestyle and longed for Yamagata. She missed her parents and her two older sisters, and she would go home to see them whenever she felt the need. Her parents operated a successful inn, which kept them financially comfortable. Her father was crazy about his youngest daughter and happily paid her round-trip fares. Several times, Komodo had come home from work to find his wife gone, and a note on the kitchen table telling him that she would be visiting her parents for a while. He never objected. He just waited for her to come back, and she always did, after a week or 10 days, in a good mood. But the letter his wife had left for him 5 days after the earthquake was different. "I am never coming back," she had written, and gone on to explain simply but clearly why she no longer wanted to live with Komodo. "The problem is that you never give me anything," she wrote. "Or, to put it more precisely, you have nothing inside you that you can give me. You are good and kind and handsome, but living with you is like living with a chunk of air. It's not your fault. There are lots of women who will fall in love with you. But please don't call me. Just get rid of the stuff I'm leaving behind." Not that she had left much of anything behind. Her clothes, her shoes, her umbrella, her coffee mug, her hairdryer, all were gone. She must have packed them in boxes and shipped them out after he left for work that morning. The only things still in the house that could be called her stuff were the bicycle she had used for shopping and a few books. The Beatles and Bill Evans CDs that Komodo had been collecting since his bachelor days had also vanished. The next day, he tried calling his wife's parents' house in Yamagata. His mother-in-law answered the phone and told him that his wife didn't want to talk to him. She sounded somewhat apologetic. She also told him that his wife would be sending him the necessary divorce forms soon, and that he should sign them and send them back right away. Komodo answered that he might not be able to send them back right away. This was an important matter, and he wanted time to think it over. "You can think it over all you want, but I don't think that'll change anything," his mother-in-law said. She was probably right, Komodo thought. No matter how long he waited, things would never be the same. He was sure of that. Shortly after he sent the papers back, Komodo asked for a week off from work. February was a slow month, and he had already told his boss what was going on in his life. He had no trouble getting permission. A colleague of Komodo's named Sasaki came over to him at lunch and said, "I hear you're taking time off. Are you planning to do something?" "I don't know," Komodo said. "What should I do?" Sasaki was a bachelor, 3 years younger than Komodo. He had a delicate build and short hair, and he wore round, gold-rimmed glasses. He talked too much and had a certain overconfident air about him, which a lot of people disliked, but he got along well enough with the easygoing Komodo. "What the hell? As long as you're taking the time off, why not travel somewhere nice?" "Not a bad idea," Komodo said. Wiping his glasses with his handkerchief, Sasaki peered at Komodo as if examining him for some kind of clue. "Have you ever been to Hokkaido?" he asked. "Never," Komodo said. "Would you like to go?" "Why do you ask?" Sasaki narrowed his eyes and cleared his throat. "To tell the truth, I've got a small package I'd like to send to Kushiro, and I'm hoping you'll take it there for me. You'd be doing me a big favor, and I'd be glad to pay for the ticket. I could cover your hotel in Kushiro, too." "A small package?" "Like this," Sasaki said, shaping a 4-inch cube with his hands. "Nothing heavy." "Something to do with work?" Sasaki shook his head. "Not at all," he said. "Strictly personal. I just don't want it to get knocked around, which is why I can't mail it. I'd like you to deliver it by hand, if possible. I really ought to do it myself, but I haven't had the time to fly all the way to Hokkaido." "Is it something important?" His closed lips curling slightly, Sasaki nodded. "It's nothing fragile, and there are no hazardous materials. There's no need to worry about it. They're not going to stop you when they x-ray it at the airport. I promise I'm not going to get you in trouble. The only reason I'm not mailing it is I just don't feel like mailing it." Hokkaido in February would be freezing cold, Komodo knew. But cold or hot, it was all the same to him. "So who do I give the package to?" "My sister, my younger sister. She lives up there." Komodo decided to accept Sasaki's offer. Thinking it over would have been too much trouble. He had no reason to refuse and nothing else to do. Sasaki called the airline immediately and reserved a ticket for 2 days later. At work the next day, he handed Komodo a box like the ones used for human ashes, only smaller, wrapped in manila paper. Judging from the feel, it was made of wood. It weighed almost nothing. Broad strips of transparent tape were wrapped around the package, over the paper. Komodo held it in his hands and studied it for a few seconds. He gave it a little shake, but he couldn't feel or hear anything moving inside. "My sister will pick you up at the airport," Sasaki said. "She'll be arranging a room for you. All you have to do is meet her at the gate." Komodo left home with a box and a suitcase wrapped in a thick shirt. The plane was far more crowded than he had imagined it would be. Why were all these people going from Tokyo to Kushiro in the middle of winter, he wondered. The morning paper was full of earthquake reports. He read it from beginning to end on the plane. the number of dead was rising. Many areas were still without water and electricity, and countless people had lost their homes. Each article contained some new tragedy, but to Komuro, those tragedies registered as oddly lacking in depth. The aftermath of the earthquake was like a distant, monotonous echo to him. The only thing he could give any serious thought to was his wife's drawing ever further away. When he grew tired of thinking about his wife and of following the lines of type, he closed his eyes and napped. When he woke, he thought about his wife again. Why had she followed the earthquake reports with such intensity, from morning to night, without eating or sleeping? What had she seen that he didn't see? Two young women wearing overcoats of similar design and color approached Komuro at the airport. One was fair-skinned and maybe 5'6", with short hair. The area from her nose to her full upper lip was oddly extended, in a way that made Komuro think of short-haired hoofed animals. The other woman was closer to 5'1", and would have been quite pretty if her nose hadn't been so small. Her long hair fell straight to her shoulders. Her ears were exposed, and there were two moles on her right earlobe which were emphasized by the earrings she wore. Both women looked to be in their mid-20s. They took Komuro to a cafe in the airport. "I'm Keiko Sasaki," the taller woman said. "My brother told me how helpful you've been to him. This is my friend, Shimao." "Nice to meet you," Komuro said. "Hi," Shimao said. "My brother tells me that your wife recently passed away," Keiko Sasaki said, with a respectful expression. Komuro waited a moment before answering. "No, she didn't die. I just talked to my brother the day before yesterday. I'm sure he said quite clearly that you had lost your wife." "I did. She left me. But, as far as I know, she's alive and well." "That's strange. I couldn't possibly have misheard something so important." She gave him an injured look. Komuro put a small amount of sugar in his coffee and stirred it gently before taking a sip. The liquid was thin, with no taste to speak of. "What the hell am I doing here?" he wondered. "Well, I guess I did mishear it. I can't imagine how else to explain the mistake," Keiko Sasaki said, apparently satisfied now. She drew in a deep breath and bit her lower lip. "Please forgive me. I was very rude." "Don't worry about it. Either way, she's gone." Shimao said nothing while Komuro and Keiko spoke, but she smiled and kept her eyes on Komuro. She seemed to like him. He could tell from her expression and her subtle body language. A short silence fell over the three of them. "Anyway, let me give you the important package I brought," Komuro said. He unzipped his suitcase and pulled the box out of the folds of the thick shirt he had wrapped it in. Keiko stretched her hands across the table, her expressionless eyes fixed on the package. After testing its weight, she did the same thing Komuro had and gave it a few shakes by her ear. She flashed a smile, as if to signal that everything was fine, and slipped the box into her oversized shoulder bag. "I have to make a call," she said. "Do you mind if I excuse myself for a moment?" "Not at all," Komuro said. "Feel free." Keiko slung the bag over her shoulder and walked off toward a distant phone booth. Komuro studied the way she walked. The upper half of her body was still, while everything from the hips down made large, smooth, mechanical movements. He had the impression that he was witnessing some moment from the past, shoved with random suddenness into the present. "Have you been to Hokkaido before?" Shimao asked. Komuro shook his head. "Yeah, I know. It's a long way to come." Komuro nodded. Then he turned to survey his surroundings. "Strange, though," he said. "Sitting here like this, it doesn't feel as if I've come all that far." "Because you flew. Those planes are too damn fast. Your mind can't keep up with your body." "You may be right." "Did you want to make such a long trip?" "I guess so," Komuro said. "Because your wife left?" Komuro nodded. "No matter how far you travel, you can never get away from yourself," Shimao said. Komodo was staring at the sugar bowl on the table as she spoke, but then he raised his eyes to hers. "It's true," he said. "No matter how far you travel, you can never get away from yourself. It's like your shadow. It follows you everywhere." Shimao looked hard at Komodo. "I bet you loved her, didn't you?" Komodo dodged the question. "You're a friend of Keiko Sasaki's?" "Right, we do stuff together." "What kind of stuff?" Instead of answering him, Shimao asked, "Are you hungry?" "I don't know," Komodo said. "I feel kind of hungry and kind of not." "Let's go and have something warm, the three of us. Eating something warm will help you relax." Shimao drove a small four-wheel drive Subaru. Keiko Sasaki sat next to Shimao, and Komodo had a cramped rear seat to himself. There was nothing particularly wrong with Shimao's driving, but the noise in the back was terrible, and the suspension was nearly shot. The car had to have more than 100,000 miles on it. The automatic transmission slammed into gear whenever it downshifted, and the heater blew hot and cold. Shutting his eyes, Komodo imagined that he had been imprisoned in a washing machine. No snow had been allowed to accumulate on the streets in Koshiro, but dirty, icy mounds stood at random intervals on both sides of the road. Dense clouds hung low, and although it was not yet sunset, everything was dark and desolate. The wind tore through the city in sharp squeals. There were no people out walking. Even the traffic lights looked frozen. "This is one part of Hokkaido that doesn't get much snow," Keiko explained in a loud voice, looking back at Komodo. "We're on the coast, and the wind is strong, so whatever piles up gets blown away. It's cold, though. Freezing cold. Sometimes it feels like it's taking your ears off." "You hear about drunks who freeze to death sleeping on the road," Shimao said. "Do you get bears around here?" Komodo asked. Keiko giggled and turned to Shimao. "Bears!" Shimao gave the same kind of giggle. "I don't know much about Hokkaido," Komodo said by way of excuse. "I know a good story about bears," Keiko said. "Right, Shimao?" "A great story," Shimao said. But their talk broke off at that point, and neither of them told the bear story. Komodo didn't ask to hear it. Soon they reached their destination, a big noodle shop on the highway. They parked in the lot and went inside. Komodo had a beer and a hot bowl of ramen noodles. The place was dirty and empty, and the chairs and tables were rickety, but the ramen was terrific. And when he had finished eating, Komodo did, in fact, feel more relaxed. "Tell me, Mr. Komodo," Keiko said, "do you have something you want to do in Hokkaido? My brother says you're going to spend a week here." Komodo thought about it for a moment, but couldn't come up with anything that he wanted to do. "How about a hot spring? I know a little country place not far from here." "Not a bad idea," Komodo said. "I'm sure you'd like it. It's really nice. No bears or anything." The two women looked at each other and laughed again. "Do you mind if I ask about your wife?" Keiko asked.
"I don't mind."
"When did she leave?"
5 days after the earthquake, so that's more than 2 weeks ago now."
"Did it have something to do with the earthquake?"
Komodo shook his head. "Probably not. I don't think so.
Still, I wonder if things like that aren't connected somehow," Shimao said with a tilt of her head.
"Yeah," Keiko said. "It's just that you can't see how."
"Right," Shimao said. "Stuff like that happens all the time."
"Stuff like what?" Komodo asked.
"Like, say, what happened with somebody I know," Keiko said.
"You mean Mr. Sayaki?" Shimao asked.
"Exactly," Keiko said. "There's this guy, Sayaki. He lives in Koshiro. He's about 40 years old, a hairstylist. His wife saw a UFO last year. She was driving on the edge of town all by herself in the middle of the night, and she saw a huge UFO land in a field. Whoosh! Like in Close Encounters. A week later, she left home. Just disappeared and never came back.
they weren't having any domestic problems or anything.
And it was because of the UFO? Komoda asked.
I don't know why, she just up and left. No note or anything. She had two kids in elementary school and she just walked out.
Not a word from her since, Keiko said.
The whole week before she left, all she'd do was tell people about the UFO. Couldn't get her to stop. She'd just go on and on about how big and beautiful it was.
She paused to let the story sink in. My wife left a note, Komoda said. We don't have any kids.
So your situation's a little better than Sayaki's, Keiko said.
Yeah, kids make a big difference, Shimao said, nodding.
Shimao's father left home when she was 7, Keiko explained with a frown. Ran off with his wife's younger sister. A silence settled over the group.
Maybe Mr. Sayaki's wife didn't run away, but was captured by an alien from the UFO? Komoda said to change the subject.
It's possible, Shimao said with a somber expression. You hear stories like that all the time.
You mean like you're walking along the street and a bear eats you kind of thing? Keiko asked.
The two women laughed.
The three of them left the noodle shop and went to a nearby Love Hotel. It was on the edge of town, on a strange street where Love Hotels alternated with gravestone dealers. The hotel Shimao had chosen was an odd building, constructed to look like a European castle. A triangular red flag flew on a Tice tower. Keiko got the key at the front desk, and they took the elevator to the room. The windows were tiny, compared with the absurdly big bed. Komuro hung his down jacket on a hanger and went to the toilet. During the few minutes that he was gone, the two women managed to run a bath, dim the lights, turn up the heat, turn on the television, examine the delivery menus from local restaurants, test the light switches at the head of the bed, and check the contents of the minibar.
The owners are friends of mine, Keiko said. I had them get a big room ready. It's a Love Hotel, but don't let that bother you.
You're not bothered, are you?
Not at all, Komoda said.
I thought this would make a little more sense than sticking you in a cramped little room in some cut-rate business hotel by the station.
I'm sure you're right, Komoda said.
Why don't you take a bath? I filled the tub.
Komoda did as he was told. The tub was huge. Komoda felt almost uneasy soaking in it alone. The couples who came to this hotel probably took baths together. When he emerged from the bathroom, Komoda was surprised to see that Keiko Sasaki had left. Shimao was still there, drinking beer and watching TV.
Keiko went home, Shimao said.
She wanted me to apologize and tell you that she'll be back tomorrow morning.
Do you mind if I stay here a little while and have a beer?
No, Komoda said. You sure it's no problem? Like, you want to be alone or you can't relax if somebody else is around or something?
Komoda insisted that it was no problem. Drinking his beer and drying his hair with a towel, he watched TV with Shimao. It was a news special on the Kobe earthquake. The same images appeared again and again. Tilted buildings, buckled streets, tearful old women, confusion, and aimless anger. When a commercial came on, Shimao used the remote to switch off the TV.
Let's talk, she said. As long as we're here.
Fine, Komoda said.
What should we talk about?
In the car, you and Keiko said something about a bear, remember? You said it was a great story.
Oh, yeah, she said, nodding. The bear story.
You want to tell it to me?
Sure, why not? Shimao got a fresh beer from the refrigerator and filled both their glasses.
It's a little raunchy, she said. You don't mind?
Komoda shook his head.
No, go ahead.
I mean, some men don't like hearing a woman tell certain kinds of stories.
I'm not like that.
It's something that actually happened to me, so it's a little embarrassing.
I'd like to hear it if you're okay with it.
I'm okay, Shimao said.
If you're okay.
I'm okay, Komoda said.
3 years ago, back around the time I started college, I was dating this guy. He was a year older than me, and he was the first guy I had sex with. One day, the two of us were out hiking in the mountains way up north. Shamal took a sip of beer. It was fall, and the hills were full of bears. That's the time of year when the bears are getting ready to hibernate. So they're out looking for food, and they're really dangerous. Sometimes they attack people. They'd done an awful job on a hiker 3 days before we went out. So somebody gave us a bell to carry with us. We were supposed to shake it while we walked to warn the bears that there were people around. Bears don't attack people on purpose. I mean, they're pretty much vegetarians. They don't have to attack people. What happens is they suddenly bump into people in their territory and they get surprised or angry and they attack out of reflex. If you walk along ringing your bell, they'll avoid you. Get it? I get it. So that's what we were doing, walking along and ringing the bell. We got to this place where there was nobody else around, and all of a sudden he said he wanted to do it. I kind of liked the idea too, so I said, okay. We went into this bushy place off the trail where nobody could see us, and we spread out a piece of plastic. But I was afraid of the bears. I mean, think how awful it would be to have some bear attack you from behind and kill you while you're having sex. I would never want to die that way. Would you? Komodo agreed that he would not want to die that way. So there we were, shaking the bell with one hand and having sex. Kept it up from start to finish. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. Which one of you shook the bell? We took turns. We'd trade off when our hands got tired. It was so weird shaking this bell the whole time while we were doing it. I think about it sometimes even now when I'm having sex and I start laughing. Komodo gave a little laugh too. Shamal clapped her hands. Oh, that's wonderful, she said. You can laugh after all. Of course I can laugh, Komodo said, but come to think of it, this was the first time he laughed in quite a while. When was the last time? Do you mind if I take a bath too? Shamal asked. No, Komodo said. While she was bathing, Komodo watched a variety show emceed by a comedian with a loud voice. He didn't find it the least bit funny, but he couldn't tell whether that was the show's fault or his own. He drank a beer and opened a packet of nuts from the minibar. Shamal stayed in the bath for a very long time. Finally, she came out wearing nothing but a towel and sat on the edge of the bed. Dropping the towel, she slid between the sheets like a cat and lay there staring at Komodo. When was the last time you did it with your wife? She asked. At the end of December, I think. And nothing since? Nothing. Not with anybody? Komodo closed his eyes and nodded. You know what I think? Shamal said. You need to lighten up and learn to enjoy life a little more. I mean, think about it. Tomorrow there could be an earthquake. You could be kidnapped by aliens. You could be eaten by a bear. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen, Komodo echoed. Ding-a-ling, Shamal said. After several failed attempts to have sex with Shamal, Komodo gave up. This had never happened to him before. You must have been thinking about your wife, Shamal said. Yep, Komodo said. But in fact, what he'd been thinking about was the earthquake. Images of it had come to him one after another, as if in a slideshow, flashing on the screen and fading away. Highways, flames, smoke, piles of rubble. He couldn't break the chain of silent images. Shamal pressed her ear against his naked chest. These things happen, she said. You shouldn't let it bother you. I'll try not to, Komodo said. Men always let it bother them, though. Komodo said nothing. Shamal played with his nipple. You said your wife left a note, didn't you? I did. What did it say? That living with me was like living with a chunk of air. A chunk of air? Shamal tilted her head back to look at Komodo. What does that mean? That there's nothing inside me, I guess. Is it true?
Could be, Komodo said. I'm not sure, though. I may have nothing inside me, but what would something be?
Yeah, really, come to think of it, what would something be?
My mother was crazy about salmon skin. She always used to wish that there were a kind of salmon that was made of nothing but skin. So there may be some cases when it's better to have nothing inside, don't you think?
Komodo tried to imagine what a salmon made of nothing but skin would be like.
But even supposing there were such a thing, wouldn't the skin itself be the something inside?
Komodo took a deep breath, raising and then lowering Shimao's head on his chest.
I'll tell you this, though, Shimao said. I don't know whether you've got nothing or something inside you, but I think you're terrific. I'll bet the world is full of women who would understand you and fall in love with you.
It said that, too.
What, your wife's note?
Uh-huh.
No kidding, Shimao said. Her earring rubbed against the skin of his chest.
Come to think of it, Komodo said, what's the something inside that box I brought up here?
Is that bothering you?
It wasn't bothering me before, but now, I don't know, it's starting to.
Since when?
Just now.
All of a sudden?
Yeah, once I started thinking about it, all of a sudden.
I wonder why it started bothering you now, all of a sudden.
Komodo stared at the ceiling for a minute.
I wonder.
The two listened to the moaning of the wind. The wind came from someplace unknown to Komodo, and it blew past to another place unknown to him.
I'll tell you why, Shimao said in a low voice. It's because that box contains the something that was inside you. You didn't know that when you carried it here and gave it to Keiko with your own hands. Now you'll never get it back.
Komodo lifted himself from the mattress and looked down at the woman. Tiny nose, moles on her earlobe. In the room silent, his heart beat with a loud, dry sound. His bones cracked as he leaned forward. For a split second, Komodo felt as if he were on the verge of committing an act of incredible violence.
Just kidding, Shimao said when she saw the look on his face.
I said the first thing that popped into my head. It was a lousy joke, I'm sorry.
Don't take it personally, I didn't mean to hurt you.
Komodo forced himself to calm down and sank his head into his pillow again. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath. The huge bed stretched out around him like a nocturnal sea. His heart was still pounding.
Are you starting to feel a little as if you've come a long way? Shimao asked.
Now, I feel as if I've come a very long way, Komodo answered honestly. Shimao traced a complicated design on Komodo's chest with her fingertip, as if casting a magic spell.
But really? She said. You're just at the beginning.
That was Brian Washington reading UFO and Kushiro by Haruki Murakami, translated from the Japanese by Jay Rubin. The story appeared in The New Yorker in March of 2001 and was republished in the magazine in March of 2011 after the earthquake and tsunami that devastated northeastern Japan. It was included in Murakami's collection After the Quake, which was published in English in 2002.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's an it bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
So, Brian, to start at the beginning of the story, this couple has a puzzling relationship from the get-go. You know, he's this classically attractive, outgoing, likable guy. She's unattractive. She's sullen. She doesn't talk. And yet Kimura feels at peace when he's with her. The tension goes out of him. He has no more bad dreams. He doesn't worry about death. How do you account for that connection, for him at least?
It's something that I'm still trying to figure out. I do think that that motif of relationship that isn't perhaps a classical match, so to speak, where the attractiveness of both parties is parallel to one another, the financial or job status of both parties isn't parallel to one another, and yet one is able to give the other something that they can't find anywhere else, is one that's always going to be interesting to extrapolate. And in this particular instance, I think that the thing that Kimura can't find anywhere else, peace, is such a commodity that it would be enough for him to stay in that relationship. Because the moment that his wife does leave him and that peace evaporates, everything seems to go to shit, you know? And his taking this journey is like an attempt to sort of find that peace, right? Or to search for that thing that he's lost.
Yeah, the exchange between the two of them where she feels she's getting nothing and where he feels he's getting everything, the meaning of life, is a bizarre one because it's not necessarily interactive.
Right. It feels as if the contentment of Kimura was parasitic in a sense, right? Because what is he giving her? It's very interesting to me how the narrative is centered entirely on his loss. Like oftentimes, every time that I read this narrative, I am left wondering what loss looked like on her end, right? Like he loses peace, and what does she lose, and what does that look like?
Right. I mean, it's possible she was getting nothing, so she's lost nothing. Right?
Absolutely.
In fact, what she got was his Beatles and Bill Evans CDs.
Yeah, which are pretty, you know, pretty rare finds. So, you know, there's a reading where she wins either way.
You could feel Murakami just really resenting that she took those.
Yeah, it does feel like a bit of a sting.
Do you think that she's known throughout the marriage that she was getting nothing, that she's, you know, living with a chunk of air? Or did it take the disaster in Kobe for her to see that? And what was it about the disaster that made her see that?
I think that the wife was aware that her relationship with Kimura wasn't entirely symbiotic and that she wasn't getting what he was getting out of it, and that the earthquake underlined the discrepancy. It was enough for her to not only reevaluate what that relation meant to her, but it was enough for her to just take action and absolutely sever herself from it in the way that sometimes, you know, we may know things and it takes some sort of outside force, some sort of outside event for us to recontextualize it.
Yeah, it's also interesting that, you know, she spends these 5 days looking at crumbled buildings and looking inside the lives of others, in a sense. You know, that when an earthquake happens and you're looking at these houses that have fallen, you're usually seeing inside them, you're seeing into other people's lives. And something about that perhaps triggered her.
Yeah, because like, how do we make sense of our own relationships? Like, how do we make sense of ourselves? It's through the relationships and the folks around us, right? So perhaps her having this time to take stock and take sense of the debris around her gave her a deeper awareness of her own situation.
Yeah. And unlike her, Kimura can't really appreciate the tragedy. And I feel a certain sympathy for that. You know, you can look at the U.S. and say there's more than 95,000 people who've died of COVID-19. There's no way to appreciate the individual tragedies of each death, right? And she seems to hold against him the fact that he's not doing that with the losses in Kobe. But who can?
Yeah, it's the sheer scale of death of the earthquake in Kobe is just astronomical, right? Like, how do you, like, what context do you place it in, right? And the same goes for just the scale of suffering in the States alone as a result of COVID and the reverberation surrounding COVID, right? There's like this sort of collapse of context that the dissolution of Komodo's relationship reveals, right? Because his immediate vicinity is largely untouched by the earthquake. And yet it's in some ways responsible for the dissolution of the peace that he has. It makes you wonder, like, does he turn to the earthquake as a sense or as a way of getting that understanding of his situation back, or does he immediately turn to his relationship?
Yeah, and it's interesting because he goes back to thinking about the earthquake two more times in the story. One is on the plane to Hokkaido, where he's reading about it and still not taking it in. And the final time is when he's in bed with Shimao. And at that point, suddenly it hits him, in a sense. He's harrowed by the images that pass through his mind. And I wonder, what do you think has happened between those moments?
I think that it's sunk in. He's gotten outside of himself over the course of the story, whether by way of distance, right? Whether that's time passing, whether that's being in a new place without having the sort of creature comforts, without having the rhythms of habit to guide him along. I think that just the passing of time had its toll on him, and that's when the devastation en masse sort of reveals itself in the ways it affects him directly, and also the ways that it doesn't affect him, right? And that's the moment when Shimao tells him, you know, really, like, you're just at the beginning. For the course of his story, he may have felt that the loss of this peace, the loss of this relationship was the end of his story, if not at least the end of an arc. And yet it's when he comes to have a sharper sense of what's been wrought that he finds himself, like, at the beginning, right? And it takes his interactions with these other folks in this new place for him to have that realization. And it's not a realization that he has, right? Like, because Shimao tells him. He doesn't have the language for it. She gives it to him, which I think is just super fascinating.
And in a sense, he's just actually finally enacted the loss in his mind. Let's look at that final scene for a second, because jumping ahead, what we have is Shimao infuriating him by kind of joking about how he's just given himself away, or has given his soul away, and he's never getting it back. And his response is to feel the surge of overwhelming, violent anger. And that, for him, is the beginning of something. But the beginning of what?
Is it the beginning of self-realization? Is it the beginning of understanding other people outside of himself, or perhaps his own contentment or his own peace? I think that that's super interesting about that moment. And, you know, the first time that I read that particular line, where it feels as if he's on the edge of that overwhelming violence, like, it just, like, haunted me for, like, a week. It's the most visceral response that we see from him for the duration of the piece. It didn't surface as a result of his wife leaving him. It didn't surface as a result of his trying to gain a grasp of the earthquake and the resulting devastation. It was this very intimate moment between him and a stranger, for the most part, telling him something about himself. And that is what brings out just this deeply visceral response from him, right? And that's when he's at the beginning, right? When he begins, perhaps, to have an awareness of himself outside of himself.
It's his first moment of non-passivity. I mean, if you think about the rest of the story, his wife leaves, he stops trying to engage her. She tells him not to question her decision. He really doesn't. Mother-in-law tells him to sign the divorce papers. He signs them. His coworker tells him to go to Hokkaido, so he goes to Hokkaido. You know, Keiko runs a bath, so he takes a bath. Like, everything he does, he's told to do. And that one moment is the only moment in the whole story that he's on the verge of doing something he hasn't been told to do. And it's a terrible thing. You know, it's murderous violence that surges up in him. But on the other hand, we sort of applaud it. Or don't we?
Well, I don't know if I applaud it. Yeah. I don't know if I co-sign that. Like,
we applaud the emotion. We applaud the experience of feeling something for him.
Right. It feels as if it's the first moment that he's engaged with the world. It is an active reaction that he's having. And the story is bereft of those active reactions from him until that moment. I mean, like, as you said, like, he goes with the flow, like, whether to keep the peace or out of a sense of searching. But he, you know, he's just moving along the whims of the world. And it's this moment that nearly coerces action out of him, right? Like, murderous action, vile action, if it's led to fruition, but action nonetheless. And that's the start for him, like the beginning of
that's
action.
The beginning. Yeah. So just to go to the elephant in the room, what's in the box?
I don't know. And I think that's what, just as like, it's a technical trick, just like as a structural trick, that is just so interesting to me, right? Like, just to have an entity or an item and a narrative and to tell the reader that there is something in it, and then to never really, like, explicitly allude to what that is, because that just forces the reader to be an active participant. And you know, Murakami, like, doesn't really give an inch in that regard, right?
No, and he may not know.
No, he himself may not know is the thing, right? Like, it could be a box with nothing in it, and then its function structurally is just this device to force contemplation and action on the reader's end. And he's just, like, fucking laughing at us as we try to put something in a box. But there's, I think that as a narrative device, it's just really sound. I mean, whatever it is deeply integral to everyone who seems to touch it as it moves from hand to hand, integral enough for it to be moved mm-hmm. in the midst of, you know, a devastating earthquake, like a national disaster. Like, this box is significant enough to be moved across the country, and for Komoro to be the one to move it.
Yeah. And in a way, Kimura's movement is stage managed by Sasaki, by his coworker, whom he doesn't seem to know very well, who maybe isn't even quite sure what's just happened, since he tells Keiko that the wife has died. And why? I know you can't answer this. Why do you think Sasaki orchestrates this for his coworker?
You know, I thought about this a lot, and I wonder if it's chance, you know, the role of chance and the role of happenstance resurfaces more than a few times in Murakami's work, and the way in which a narrator's or a character's proximity to chance and happenstance can absolutely reroute the trajectory of not only their life, but their understandings about themselves. I wonder if it's chance. I wonder if it's something that Sasaki sees in Komoda, right? Whether it's something that's seen as a result of his wife having left him, or whether perhaps he is that empty vessel that his wife tells him that he is, and therefore a candidate to move this item across the country.
Which is also possibly an empty vessel.
Right, right. Perhaps they're a match made for one another, and Sasaki identifies that.
Yeah. And then when he gets to Kushiro, everything around him seems a little bit off. You know, he looks at Keiko. She's got this kind of weirdly shaped face that makes him think of a hoofed animal. And when she walks, she makes these large mechanical movements with her bottom half. And he feels something from the past is happening in the present. Everything about her throws him off. And perhaps that's the intent. Perhaps her presence is simply in the story to unsettle him enough that he will reach the final end point. Or the beginning point? What do you think?
I think that his understanding and his introduction to someone that is so unlike him, and perhaps so unlike his expectations of what a person can be is not at all unrelated to the sort of long journey that he alludes to at the end of the piece. It's not only the exchange of words that he has with Shimao that sort of conjures that beginning, but also his initial interactions with these new folks and these new space that forces him to take stock of the world. Because it doesn't seem as if he's taken stock of it in the moments after his wife has left him, right? Like all these major events are happening, like back to back to back to back, perhaps enough to give him vertigo, perhaps enough to shake up his general understanding of what matters and what doesn't. And so these interactions in this new place could be read as the first steps that he's taken in order to find himself like as an active participant in the world.
Yeah. And perhaps Kimura has to feel violence in himself in order to appreciate it when it happens outside of himself.
Yeah, because it is a, even without violence on the page, it's a deeply violent moment, right? Like the introduction of violence in and of itself is enough to absolutely shift the story. So maybe the proximity to that violence or the place that violence has taken place, right? Like natural violence, violence upon people nonetheless, is enough to fracture and perhaps reshape an understanding of what that place means to you.
Yeah. And then in the middle of the story and in the title, we have a UFO.
Yes. yeah, a literal UFO.
A literal UFO. And I wonder why it's there. I wonder if we're supposed to, you know, see Kimura as, or the box he carries as a kind of unidentified flying object, you know, that flies from Tokyo to Kushiro.
I wonder.
Why do you think it's there? Why do you think it's in the title?
That's also something that I've been trying to parse. I mean, and the question that I come back to every time I think about it is whether or not a UFO is in any way as shocking or as unbelievable as the toll of the earthquake in Kobe, right? One of the deadliest and costliest natural events ever to strike that country, right? They're both incomprehensible. And having them in the same narrative forces the reader to evaluate what is shocking. I mean, like the first time that I read the story, when I came to the UFO, like I just read past it because it wasn't in any way as visceral as the earthquake and the devastation surrounding it to me. So I wonder, again, like the context collapse, like having all of these massive things in proximity to one another, like it forces the reader to reevaluate and question, like, okay, which of these is truly beyond? Like, which one of these like eclipses my understanding?
And in a sense, it's a visitation, whether by aliens or by natural disaster. It's something that changes the course. And as with the earthquake, it changes the course for someone off stage, you know, someone we don't know, who's not a presence in the story, because it's a story told about a woman who's, we don't know, even know who she is, whose life is changed by the UFO. But her life means nothing to us in the same way that strangers' lives in Kobe don't individually mean something.
Yeah. And the stories, I think in a lot of ways, like this story is like a study on like what stories can do to you. Stories that are of a devastating event that perhaps doesn't affect your immediate situation, and how this particular person is moving through the world, and in which stories touch him, like which stories permeate him, and which stories just sort of like roll off his back.
Yeah. I guess the title gives us a slight clue that we're supposed to pay attention to the UFO when it turns up.
Yeah. It's just a tiny clue.
But it's funny. I should mention there's a Murakami story coming out in the fiction issue, actually, the same day that this podcast comes out. And it involves a monkey. And for our Q&A, I asked him, you know, this monkey's been outcast from human society, he's been outcast from monkey society. Is he a symbol of something? And And Haruki says, well, you know, sometimes a monkey is just a monkey. I'm interested in the monkey. So sometimes a UFO is just a UFO.
Yeah, sometimes. Yes. Yeah, it's just a UFO. The box is just a box, right? And the story is, you know, less about what's in the box than perhaps the conduit that's moving it.
The action it sets off.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Brian.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Haruki Murakami has published more than a dozen novels in English, including The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, 1Q84, and most recently, Killing Commendatore. A winner of the Franz Kafka Prize, the Jerusalem Prize, and the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, among others, he's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 1990. Brian Washington's story collection, Lot, was published last year, and a novel, Memorial, comes out later this year. He's a winner of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award, the Ernest J. Gaines Award, and the International Dylan Thomas Prize. You can download more than 150 previous episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast or subscribe to the podcast for free in the Apple Podcast section of the iTunes Store. On the Writer's Voice Podcast, you can hear short stories from the magazine read by their authors. You can find the Writer's Voice and other New Yorker podcasts on your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this program on our Facebook page or rate and review us in Apple Podcasts on iTunes. The New Yorker Fiction Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.